Blog Talk Radio.
It's that time again, another episode of Sports Card Live. We take a magnifying glass to the sports card industry. News, reviews, thoughts, the occasional tangents, and free stuff. Hosted by Dan Rage, Ryan, and Doug Fresh. Boom!
Pack Rippers and Sports Nuts, welcome to another edition of Sports Card Live. We will be joined shortly by Layton from LaytonSportsCards.com. I'm going to talk a little Panini Roundtable and his thoughts on the industry moving forward. It's a big release week for the sports card industry. Bowman Draft, immaculate NBA. Will it live up to flawless, or will people be buying it? We'll be talking about that. And also some limited football. And then at the end of the week, Bowman Sterling. So Bowman Sterling football. So empty your wallet and buy some sports cards. So we'll be talking about that and amongst other things. Dan, I thought I was having a nightmare when I woke up and the Rams beat the Colts. How does that happen?
Dude, Kayvon Austin, man. What, seventh pick in the draft, running back punts, making plays. Three receptions, 170 yards or something. But, dude, the Rams have been, the Rams have been hit or miss, man. Like, we played the Seahawks well. Then we got kind of, boat raced by the Titans. We were just couldn't really – the game is close, but we kind of played like crap. And then we beat the Colts. So, I don't know. A weird team. Very inconsistent team.
Hey, you guys got boat raced by the Niners, too. You forgot that part.
No. That was a preseason game. Game didn't count.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if it was it seems like Indianapolis is really missing Reggie Wayne last couple weeks. They pulled that one out the week before with T.Y. Hilton at the end, but that was I wanted to know what the line was on that. It got to have been like 400-1 or something for the Rams to beat the Colts in Indy.
Easily 400-1. You know, the issue with the Colts is that on offense, they're one-dimensional. It's pass first, and that's pretty much it. Even though they have T. Rich back there, I mean, he's your fantasy guy. What's he averaging? Maybe 2 yards a carry?
Pardon my French, but it's kind of like T. Bitch right now. The guy's just not doing anything.
So.
What's up, Ryan? How you doing, man?
Doing fantastic. Working on my set over here that's coming out in December. So, diligently working on that, getting the hits together. I'm going to have the industry first twerking cards. The cards will actually twerk. So that's going to be an industry first. So.
Nice.
Twerking autos, but seriously, though, there's actually a college basketball game tonight, Duke and Kansas, I think at it's like 7 p.m. Pacific time. Jabari Parker and Andrew Wiggins playing. Parker's on Duke and Wiggins is on Kansas. So these guys might go like 1-2 or 2-3 in the NBA drafts coming up. So just a little heads up to anybody who wants some late night television, I guess, if you're on the East Coast.
Nice. I mean, what do you think about – I haven't really had a chance to sit down and watch a whole lot of basketball, but what do you think about the rookie class this year? I mean, Michael Carter-Williams obviously did pretty well at the beginning. I heard he had a bad game last night. But so far?
Yeah, I've seen a lot of these guys play. Carter-Williams, I'd be selling his cards, like boom, boom, boom. He's going to get a lot of minutes, and he's going to have good games and bad games. He doesn't have a whole lot of jump shot. He is somewhat athletic, good defensive player, but he's not, like, on the level of Lillard, Kyrie, some of these younger guards we're seeing, obviously somebody like Westbrook. Even Eric Bledsoe in Phoenix is absolutely amazing. Eric Bledsoe, if you bought in on that guy's sensational. I don't even know if his cards have blown up. He's a triple-double waiting to happen in Phoenix, and I think Phoenix is, like, 5-2 right now. The guy's amazing. Some of the other rookies, like Oladipo, decent player, has played decent, makes a lot of turnovers. I'm trying to think some of the other rookies that I've seen that have at least stand out a little bit. There's not a whole lot, to be honest. I think that's why people grabbed onto Carter Williams, because, you know, he did start hot, but he's going to have a lot more games like he did last night, where he just doesn't shoot the ball well. I mean, he didn't shoot the ball well in college. So I'd be selling all his autographs and be looking at, you know, there's a kid in Atlanta, Schroeder, Dennis Schroeder. I don't know if he's even in the Panini product. He's going to be a backup. He's got some game, actually. He's not going to play good minutes, but he's a guy you could buy cheap, because I think at some point he actually is going to be a starting point guard somewhere. That's the one name that I remember watching Atlanta one night, and I was like, wow, this kid Dennis Schroeder. I think he was, you know, like a mid pick or something even too. So Ben McLemore in Sacramento, I know he kind of had some hype. He's had some decent games, and he could shoot from the outside. It's a little thin this year, but somebody like Oladipo, I think, is going to end up being a very good player and do a lot of different things, fill up the stat sheet. Carter Williams, I'd be a little careful with, especially if you're trying to buy, because I just don't see it. You know, especially compared to all these other talented point guards around the league. So, you know, we'll see, but it's early. And so far, it's actually probably a little better than maybe people thought it would be. So these guys are a little better than maybe we thought.
I'm looking at the stats, and actually, yeah, Michael Carter-Williams is off to an early lead with 8 games played at 17 points a game, but he's actually got the lowest field goal percentage at 38%. So, I mean, granted his volume, he doesn't have the lowest, but he's up there for lowest. Granted, he's probably taking a lot more volume than some of these other guys. He's got by far the most minutes at 36 he's averaging a game. Nate Walters from Milwaukee is averaging 32. Another guy I remember hearing from Gonzaga is getting a lot of minutes, and he's third in points, is Kelly Olynyk.
Yeah.
Big white kid from Gonzaga. Yeah, he's like a Canadian. He had a little bit of buzz. I remember in college, I kept seeing reports on him last year, so I don't know how his cards will sell, but he's in a big market team, and, you know, Boston maybe needs a good rebounding center there, so.
Right, and he's getting opportunity to play because they have nobody in Boston. I mean, oh, my God, the cupboard is just dry in Boston. They're starting Jordan Crawford and Avery Bradley. Avery Bradley's a decent player, but whew. And then you go Jeff Green, Brandon Bass, and then they're starting that kid, Olynyk or whatever, who's a decent player, but he's more of a, you know, he's not going to be like a star center in the league. He's more of a role player kind of guy, you know, rebounder type guy, hustle kind of guy, even maybe more of a bench player. So there's some teams that are pretty thin. And the Celtics, I think, are definitely, they don't have anybody, you know, that can score. Philly's got, you know, Carter Williams played well. Evan Turner's a very good player, maybe a little underrated. Thaddeus Young, Spencer Hawes is maybe an underrated player. Phoenix, I still can't underrate Phoenix. What, Eric Bledsoe? That guy is an absolute beast. He was a rookie a couple years ago, and he got traded over from the Clippers, so.
I think he was 11-12, right? I think I actually have his hoops auto somewhere, Eric Bledsoe.
Yeah, the guy's a stud and going to be a stud for a while. Very, very good player. I've been watching him a lot, Phoenix, a lot. Can't say enough about that. So, but some good college ball on tonight that kind of previews actually almost next. You got Julius Randle, I think, coming up in about an hour playing. He's going to be a top three pick. And then the two kids, Parker and Wiggins, are squaring off. Next year's basketball is just going to be explosive if these guys are even somewhat decent. It's really something to look forward to. And hopefully these guys in the league now are just continue to get better.
Yeah, it looks like Eric Bledsoe is in the 10-11 rookie crop. And actually, you can get a pretty decent card for $30 right now. It looks like his prices have raised a little bit because of the, you know, how he's done this year so far. But might be a guy to invest in, you know, get a card, you know, $30. It might be if he goes 5 or 6 games straight and kills it, like you were saying with the triple-doubles. you could turn around and maybe profit $70 in, you know, a couple, five or seven days. So it might be a guy to invest in.
Yeah, he was drafted by the Clippers, right?
Yep.
Yeah. All of his rookies are on the Clippers.
Awesome. Okay. Is he a point guard?
Yeah. He's a guard. I think he's a shooting guard, but
he's playing point. Yeah, he's kind of the hybrid, kind of in the. He doesn't have Russell Westbrook's game, but he's in that mold. Very strong guy. I mean, the kid looks like an NFL running back. It's so, you know, ripped. He's got a little bit of a jumper. It's just super athletic. Can get to the rim like it will. So it's if he continues to work on his shot, and his passing isn't that bad. I mean, the kid's got a lot of talent, a lot of talent. I would say more than Kyrie. I'd rather have Eric Bledsoe than Kyrie Irving. So it shows you the price discrepancy, I'm sure, between their rookie autographs. I'd much rather have Bledsoe. I mean, the guy looks like an NFL running back and is more explosive. I think Kyrie will need to break down at some point probably during his career. And, just doesn't have that kind of that bull mentality that like somebody like Chris Paul does, Westbrook has, I think Eric Bledsoe has. So, that's a guy to keep an eye on. His stuff is cheap. Don't be shy to pull the trigger because he's got a lot of talent. And maybe they'll put some pieces around him in Phoenix there.
Well, and let me get your opinion on Kyrie because people are starting to kind of worry a little bit. I mean, his stat line, he's averaging 19 points a game. He's 24th in the league in points right now. But he's shooting 37% from the field, which is low for him. Some people are – I've seen some threads of, you know, sell now. I mean, what are your thoughts on Kyrie? Would you hold or would you sell?
I'd sell because I could lift a lot of – I mean, I'd rather have John Wall right now as a basketball player. Not speaking about cards. He's just more explosive. He's quicker. I could name a lot of guards that I'd rather have right now over Kyrie. Kyrie doesn't really pop to the mind because he doesn't have that, like, explosive athleticism. Can he dunk? Yeah. But he's not going to come down and, like, bash on you like Westbrook can, like Derrick Rose can, even after his injury. I mean, Derrick Rose is still working back into shape. But, you know, Wall, I'd rather have Wall, Rose, Westbrook, Bledsoe, Chris Paul, obviously. And there's probably some other ones that I'm just not coming to mind. But, you know, now he's not even, you know, in the top five of point guards in the league. So I would sell. There's going to be other point guards coming in the league that are probably be better than him. I just don't see the explosiveness and that just, you know, that just extreme athleticism that somebody like Kobe has, that some of these best players in the league are just super, super athletic and can get to the rim at will, take punishment. That's what you have to be to have, like, an extended career, you know, just this long, long career. If you're built like Kyrie, you better be able to shoot like Stephen Curry.
Right.
I'd rather have Stephen Curry than Kyrie Irving. I might rather have Klay Thompson as a two guard.
I was just going to say, Klay Thompson averages 20 points a game so far.
Yeah. There's a lot of guys 51%
from the field for Klay Thompson so far.
He's like out, and he's a little bit, he's not just a shooter. You know, Thompson is not just like a Kyle Korver. I mean, Thompson could do more things. You know, he's not going to start the dribble, but he's good.
Yeah, his inside game really isn't that bad, and his defense is getting a lot better. So, I mean, Klay Thompson's becoming like, you know, an all around player. That guy's a stud.
The Warriors got to be at least behind the Clippers as far as, you know, in the West, I would think, or at least in the top three, but. But I was going to say, as it relates to cards, just looking at the top 20 guys so far, obviously it's early on. We're only at 8 games. Some teams have only played 6. But in the top 20, you got a decent amount of guys from the double rookie class. Not a surprising name because he's kind of a big name, but Bradley Beal is absolutely playing out of his mind right now. He's averaging 21 points, 41% from the field. You know, a guy that was kind of hyped at the beginning but then kind of wasn't hyped. So compared to the Damian Lillards of the world. So Bradley Beal for the Wizards doing real well, and you'd probably see a little bit of a spike in his cards. Damian Lillard's averaging 21 points a game with 391 from the field. And Anthony Davis, the unibrow, is averaging 21.7 and 46 from the field. So you got, you know, and Klay Thompson's 19th with what I did, with 51% from the field. So there's three or four guys from the 12-13 that could potentially be in the top 10 this year. So what we said about the products earlier, about holding on to some products, I mean, it might ring true with these guys. If Kyrie Irving can turn it around and get in the top 20, get in the top 10, I mean, you're talking about a monster rookie class from the double rookie class.
I would rather have all four of those guys you named than Kyrie Irving. Especially Anthony Davis is going to be an absolute beast. I mean, Anthony Davis is going to be a really good player. He's still really young, but that guy is going to be an absolute force, like in the Tim Duncan mode, but maybe even more athletic than Duncan. I mean, this guy's going to be a beast. Lillard is amazing. Lillard is absolutely amazing. So, but Beal, too, like you said, Beal. Feels really good too. Can really shoot, and they use him a lot. I mean, he's getting a ton of shots in Washington. So, those are this is going to be a really good class because Davis is going to be sneak up on people and get better and better and better and better because that guy has a lot of talent and he plays really hard, super athletic. Like I was saying, I mean, you know, if his stuff's a lot cheaper than Kyrie, I'd be buying Davis because he's going to be in the league for 15 years, if he wants to be, and play at a real high level. That's they should just do a double rookie class all the time. figure out how to do that all the time. They should have done that this next time. Like they should have just held off and waited till these new kids come in for this new draft.
I always kind of relate back to the fact that, you know, obviously Immaculate comes out tomorrow. Flawless just came out. And Kyrie Irving is his third year, but we still really have rookie cards, you know. Kind of crazy. And you're still getting rookie cards from Kyrie Irving, and he's already played 8 games into his third season. So it's a little nuts.
Right.
So. Speaking of Portland with Lillard, you also got LaMarcus Aldridge just tearing it up. Guys, 50% from the field, 22.6 points. So, I mean, Portland, you know, with these two guys, you know, might be a force if they can get it together and stay consistent.
That's right.
But, all right, well, we got Rich on the line from LeightonSportsCards.com, so we're going to go ahead and bring Rich on. What's going on, Rich?
What's up, gentlemen? How's it going tonight?
What's up? Chilling,
chilling.
What's going on?
Not much, man. Just my phone's recovering from a bit of a hangover. Want to thank you guys for getting me the second pick in the draft last night on Flawless. I apparently got so excited I dropped my phone into a cup of beer at the Sixers game.
Nice. No good.
So, yeah, did the old use the old bag of rice trick, and here I am, man. Phone's working
nice.
And everything.
That would explain why it's like a little slurry because your phone's drunk, you know. So it makes sense.
It's all the phone, man.
No, I'm just messing with you. It sounds just as good as my phone. So, yeah, I've actually used that rice trick. If you're not familiar with that out there, if you ever drop your phone, I think mine was in the toilet. Luckily, it wasn't a toilet. It had been used at the time. It was before. And I basically had to use the same trick. I had to unscrew it. I think it was my iPhone 4. I had to unscrew it, put rice. And yeah, rice really does the tricks, soaks out all the moisture, and you're good to go. So... But we definitely wanted to catch up with you, Rich, and wanted to segue probably right into the you were part of the Panini Roundtable, which is offered to certain hobby shops. And as much as you can divulge into it, I wanted to kind of talk about what that is. For those of you who don't know what the Panini Roundtable is, it's a group of shops that kind of, you know, try to improve Panini and Panini Ask Questions on what kind of ideas that the hobby shop owners can do to improve their product or what kind of concerns. So maybe you can kind of give us a background of how it started and what went down.
Sure. Well, they actually swore me to secrecy, so we're going to have to actually burn this recording.
Okay, I'm sorry. I didn't
want to
put
you
on the
spot. Yeah, yeah. I went through a whole ordeal. I mean, I got branded the whole bit, man. So, we're going to basically got emailed a little bit ahead of time of this phone call. It was a big conference call. This is the only meeting that we've actually had via phone so far, and it was orchestrated by Tim Franz let me think, DJ and DJ Kasmarak, and I believe two other of the big wigs there at Panini America, and they wanted to get everybody. Well, I believe they invited, I believe there's like somewhere around 50, 60 stores all together in this roundtable. I'll be honest with you, I think maybe 50% showed up, probably about half showed up to the actual conference call, which was a little interesting, to say the least. It was pretty revealing to all the problems that people say that we're having in the hobby and, you know, Panini this and Panini that, and then they literally give them like an open mic night to complain about their problems and how to come up with solutions for those problems, and they're willing to listen to them, and half the people don't show up. So that kind of gives you a good idea of, you know, who really cares about the hobby and who really loves it, I guess. It was pretty revealing. excuse me. What they basically started off with was, you know, what they thought, you know, they wanted you to let them know what you thought of their entire company as a whole. Right off the bat, what you thought they were doing for hobby shops, what they thought they were doing for online, what they thought of the products, I mean, top to bottom, like a grand view of things. And then they basically went from that into basically people, you know, it segued into probably, it went off basically into five or so tangents from that original starting point. Into basically redemptions, people not getting redemption filled, people complaining about, I lost this customer because, you know, I had this guy who was a whale in my shop, he spent thousands of dollars, and he stopped buying because Panini loaded up everything with redemptions. And Panini said, okay, well, here's the deal, you know, for football, we're 99% live. 99%, which is absolutely absurd if you think about it. I mean, that's a pretty impressive number. I think it was 98 or 99% across the board they were live. I think hockey was somewhere around like 95%. You know, they're basically saying, look, we have a lot of new people in charge of these programs now, and they're really working hard to make sure that they turn these numbers around. That, you know, from 2010, 2009, 2010, 2011 Panini products, they had a lot of trouble with redemptions. I'm sure you guys know very well. They brought in a whole new team of people across the board, from the, you know, higher up people, from management all the way down to just normal, you know, the normal working level or entry level positions. So they're basically, you know, they're pleading with hobby shops to give them a chance to turn these things around. And I don't know, it turned into a major complaint fest, if you will. But, you know, they heard what they had to say. They were willing to listen to solutions. A few people had some interesting ideas of how to improve products and make them more collectible and make them more valuable in the secondary market. A lot of people were complaining about the watering down of checklists, which, you know, Doug and myself, and I know a few others that also complain about that, you know, there's just no need for 30 different, you know, products with the same guys in it. And it gets a bit ridiculous. They need more veterans, more product mix. You know, so that was probably a good 75% of the conversation right there. But hopefully something good will come out of it. I hope I'm sure, actually. I know Tim Franz pretty well. We talk pretty often. He's a really good guy, and he listens to the customers. There's no doubt about it. If I see Tim, you know, there was a major problem with this, that, or other thing, I guarantee you that the next time around, they're going to focus on that. I mean, you know, they truly do listen. I'm not nobody important, believe me. I'm nothing on the map. And he's willing to take time out of his day. I mean, this is the president of sales or vice president. I think it's the president of sales of the hobby end of Panini. That's pretty impressive that the guy's willing to take like 20 minutes out of his day to talk to me on the phone about, you know, prominence football or something like that. So, all I know is that, I mean, there might have been a large number of complaints and a large number of stores complaining about losing customers and this and that, but I don't see Tops or Upper Deck or anybody else making these efforts. So to me, just the fact that they were willing to make this roundtable program and do something for shops or whoever else or for anybody for that matter in the hobby, that to me speaks volumes in itself, and you know, it really sets them apart.
Yeah, I definitely agree. I think that's definitely the right step, and you know, maybe there's any company needs to hear out their customers. I mean, that's the main thing, is being able to find out what they can fine-tune, what didn't work. I mean, because sometimes they don't know what works or what doesn't work, so getting that forum to, you know, have people voice their opinion is great. What would you say the overall mood was from everybody else on the line without going, you know, without ruining your secrecy?
there were a lot of people there that were ready, there were some people there that seemed like they were ready to complain about what they were going to complain about. Like they had like it, they're like, oh my God, this is my chance to complain about redemption, and that's what I'm going to do. Rather than sitting there and saying, well, maybe I should ask why the redemptions aren't getting filled and what they're planning on doing about it. Like, I feel like it was just a lot like Ryan had talked about. I mean, I didn't have a chance to go to like the Tops Open Forum that they did at the summit. I know Ryan did, and it was, you know, a major. It started to turn into a major complaint fest. And you know, what are you going to do about this? What are you going to do about that? It kind of had that vibe for a little while. I'll tell you, though, they took control of the situation, and they stated, like, this is where we're at right now with our products right this minute. This is where we're going to be, and this is where we're going to be moving forward from here on in. So expect this from us. You know what I mean? Like, we're going to go above and beyond to make sure that our products are 99.9% live, if not 100%. That's what they shoot for. They're not, you know, their aim is not to have redemption. Product. They don't want them in there. You know, that's, people have to understand that. They do not want redemptions in their product. They don't want them there.
Right.
They'd rather have the card in the product. And they realize when people get a redemption card in a product that they don't like it. So that's their main goal, bringing the redemptions down. They want the products to be better. They want the sales to be better across the board. Obviously, as a company, you would want that. But I think they're really... They're trying to shift the spotlight back a little bit more towards the hobby shops. Obviously, it's not going to be completely, you know, they're not going to be able to focus completely or solely on hobby shops because of the sheer fact that, you know, online retail and online group breaking and case breaking obviously is where, you know, most of the money is spent now, but they're trying to still keep hobby shops in their, you know, part of their best interests and, you know, do something for them. And then I think, you know, nobody else is really trying to do that. So you can't, you know, I think you have to give them credit for that.
Definitely. Ryan, did you have any thoughts or questions on the roundtable itself?
Yeah, I could only imagine how an Upper Deck or I guess more specifically like a Topps call would go. I bet it was even a little more positive than if Topps got on it and did a call, especially about redemptions. If people are complaining about Panini redemptions, I don't know. It seems like they get fulfilled at a higher rate. Maybe I'm not, you know, maybe I'm wrong about that. But I guess one question I had, you mentioned that some people had some good ideas about how to make the product better. Can you share about what, like one or two of those ideas and you know, kind of what made them stand out?
Well, yeah. Part of it was, well, I can speak for myself when I say that I was trying to be positive with this meeting. You know, I try to be that way when it comes to, you know, the manufacturers and everything. I like to try to be optimistic. I like to try to stay looking forward. But they brought up, what do you think we could do with, you know, say, you know, X product, say we'll just use like Prism, for example, you know, what do you think we could do with that to make it better or make it, you know, more sustainable? So it doesn't, you know, they don't want the factory price of the product to go down $30 after 30 days that it's been out. They don't want that, obviously. It makes your brand look bad. It makes you as a company look bad. It makes if people just wait for the product to go down in price and then they buy it then, you know, instead of buying it when it's out and then, you know, it sells out and then obviously the company looks better and the manufacturers make more money, et cetera, et cetera. I brought up the idea of getting rid of base cards, literally, almost, and utterly, completely. Obviously, I got a lot of silence. You know, it kind of, me bringing it up also brought up the idea of more numbered cards, numbered parallels, you know what I mean? People like parallels. They sell. They believe it or not. I mean, for a base card, it sells, you know. Even if it just has a numbered stamp or a different color or a different refractor type, you know, face or whatever, I think that was a big part of what people would like. You know, more numbered cards rather than that. The single color relic was another thing that was brought up. And people are saying, look, couldn't you, if it's going to be single color, couldn't you make it bigger? Instead of having like a small window with a single color, it's just a pointless hit, if you will, or, you know, it's a pointless attraction to the product. If it's going to be a small patch, it should be multicolored. Somebody actually brought up the idea, and I argued against this, and then people, it got a little rowdy, but somebody had brought up the idea of making, like taking out, say like a product has four hits, two autos and two relics, taking out two of those hits and making the two hits nicer, which I, you know, I was like, no, that's not going to work. It's like, you just can't do that. You can't have a product that always has four hits and then say, oh, well, there's only two hits. Well, guess what? If one of those two hits is horrible, people are going to trash the product. You know what I mean? It's just going to get ripped apart and no one's going to buy it. Unless you, like, cut the price in half and you make it two hits and the two hits are nicer, that's about the only way it would work. So, that, you know, there was a lot of ideas in that sense, you know, kind of tossed around. But, you know, they were taking notes. There's no doubt about it. They were, you know, they were listening to what people were saying. You know, for me, you know, at least as an online casebreaker and a hobby shop owner, I don't have people coming in asking me for sets of cards. It just doesn't happen anymore. Topps produces factory sets, and once in a while I'll have somebody, I mean once in a while, once every 2 months, maybe 3 months, they come in, they ask for a set of 2013 Topps football or baseball, and that's it. And nobody ever comes in and asks for a set of Panini Prism or a set of Absolute Football, like the base set. So I feel like they could take that money of the production of those cards and put it into just one small aspect of what they're already producing for that set. You know, just take the money and buy a few extra autographs or buy a few extra whatever it might be. Just use that money and make another style refractor, number it or something along those lines. So, I don't know. That's, you know, there's a few ideas.
Yeah, and I agree with that. I think that
you know, we talked about this about a year ago when Prism Basketball came out and then Select Basketball came out. We're like, wow, Panini's on the right track of bringing the non-auto, non-jersey with the gold to get some value to the hobby. And we thought, wow, they're in the right direction. But if you fast forward to now, all those colored refractors are back down to worth nothing again. And I don't know what happened over the course of the year. You look at Prism draft picks, the colored non-autos. I mean, obviously prospects are is a whole other type of collector. But what Topps has done in comparison to Panini, Topps' base cards, their rookie cards and stuff like that, do have value. They're green. I mean, they're golds, they're blues, they're reds. They've done a great job maintaining those colors across the board with their baseball products at least. Maybe their football products don't sell as well. But Panini needs to look at it like, what do we do? How can we bring value to the non-hit? You know,
right.
And I don't know what they can do. Maybe, like you said, limit the base run. I had the idea a couple weeks ago, and I've shared it off air with everybody, that, you know, maybe make four packs with four hits and then one pack with 30 base cards, one from each team, and have your parallels in there. And being that you're only going to get 30 base cards a pack in a base-heavy set, scarcity is going to bring on the base cards, and then maybe they sell for more. So, I mean, that's the focus with Panini, is that their base cards just, they don't sell. No one collects their set. It's not desirable like Topps is, and what can we do to change that?
Well, I mean, everything across the board in this hobby always will be and always has been scarcity. If there's a 300-card base set, and it's this, you know, a $90 a box product, there's a billion cards out there. You could build like 400,000 sets of Panini Prism Baseball, and there'd still be a whole crap load of cases out there. So if you maybe make the base card scarce and number it, like, what was it, Titanium Hockey? Didn't they number it to, like, the number draft pick they were or whatever, the base cards from that, for the rookies that year?
Or their jersey or something like that. Yeah,
their,
I remember that.
Yeah, their jersey number or something. Maybe if you do, like if you had a theme, like, some sort of, like, there's got to be some sort of collectible purpose to the base card. If it's just a base card and it has no other collectible purpose, nobody wants it. You know, like we were talking about this earlier, and I've been thinking about this a lot. If there weren't autos and relics out there, if there were not autos and relics in baseball cards, people would be collecting something else within cards. So they would be chasing sets. Manufacturers would catch on to what was working for them, so they would make something a little more scarce and make it worth more. They're always going to collect what the hardest thing to collect is. Obviously, everybody wants the one-of-one. So if that's the hardest thing to collect, that's what people are going to go after. If the hits inside of the series are autos and relics, that's what people want. They literally will throw the base cards in the trash. They do not care about them. They're going after the hits. We have kids that come in our shop and rip packs. They don't even look at the base cards half the time. Now, this isn't every single situation, don't get me wrong. This is just a general view of this. You know, I really think that that's what people are going after. So why not make, like, an autograph set or a relic set that means something? Like, here's the Eagles team with a piece of jersey for every single Eagles player this season. Like, instead of making it like, okay, well, here's 430 different Michael Vick jerseys. You know, I'm just saying to bring more collectability to the cards themselves.
I got it. You know what they should do? Next year with Prestige, there's a diamond in every card, and you got one of these.
Yo, tame up!
You know, and it's like they sell the boxes for $1,500, and you got all diamond base cards, number to 20. Boom. That's it. Solved it.
Where'd you come up with that?
Oh, just off the top of the dome right now.
You're an idea, man.
Just everything, every low end, even top series one, diamond. Just everything. You can't even buy a box. can't even buy a box under a grand. It's everything. Even prominence, it's got diamonds in it. And you got gold-plated cards. And everything is just $2,000 a box. And then since they've done that with the base sets, then you get to flawless, and there's, like, signed cars. Like, it's like you get a pack, and it's like in a freight, and there's, like, cars that are signed by Durant and Kobe, and they're gold-plated. And it's $700,000 a pack. That's where we need to go. That's what I'm saying. You know what I mean?
That'd be an interesting online case.
Yo, Tama!
Sorry, I had to play it one more time. But, yeah, sorry to cut you off with Gary Payton there.
No, but I understand, like, that's the other side of it. You're right. You're actually right on a certain level that, you know, you also, at the same time, you can't steer your entire print run towards a more expensive product. I get that. You have to have a low end in order to have a high end. You have to have
right.
bad cards in order to have good cards. There has to be duality in the product, in your whole business, if you will. You have to have a low end. You know, I get that. But in your middle, you know, I almost feel like there's not much room for the mid-end product anymore. You know, it's either super high-end that everybody wants or just the case hits out of middle-of-the-road products or certain players, if you will. But the base cards from those products, are just fillers.
Yeah. And you know, maybe eBay, unfortunately, has a lot to do with people being able to, at their fingertips, on their phones, on their iPads, on their computers, watching, you know, basically getting in a break or opening packs and then immediately going to their phone. I'm guilty of this too. Immediately going to their phone and going, man, I just pulled a Salvador Perez auto. Oh, man, it's a $20 card. I just spent $150 on the box. I'm pissed.
Right.
Whether it's 10 years ago where they didn't have and we just went by the, in quotations, the book. I mean, the book may have priced that Salvador Perez at $100 and everybody's like, wow, I got a $100 card. But
right.
we go by
yeah,
eBay.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
Now. So eBay is kind of, in a sense, kind of made things less collectible and made it more about the dollar signs, I guess, so to speak, more the gambling aspect of it. And maybe there wouldn't be guys like us if there wasn't no eBay either. So, I mean, it's created it's a little bit of both.
Yep.
But,
that's an interesting point. And that's, you know, I feel like that's kind of what, you know, that's kind of the same idea behind the Collector Revolution and, you know, places of that nature. They're trying to pull away from that whole, like, got to sell it right now. I don't care what I get back. I got to rip that next box. I want the case hit type mentality. You know, I think they're trying to pull away from that and get closer to what we used to be at with going to the card shop or going wherever that this day and age, going to your local online case breaker or your favorite online case breaker, whoever that may be, and getting your cards and evaluating the price from there. But like you said, I mean, people are just, I mean, they're listing cards before they have them. They're selling them as fast as they can and getting what they can back for them. You know, that's kind of where the internet has taken this, you know?
It's funny. I bet you there's, and I don't know what the percentage is, but I bet you there's a lot of people that buy into either group breaks or go to their card shop that have spent, I'm just going to throw a number out there. Say they spent $5,000 this year on cards, and if you go to their closet, they have no cards in their closet because they've
right.
sold them all. They've sold them all. Maybe they have that one $10 one that they didn't spend, but it's like, I don't know. To me, I would look at it at the end of the day and be like, man, I don't have anything to show, you know, because it's like as soon as the guy spikes, you got the, you know, Kyrie that, or somebody that spiked or, you know, Michael Waka came up. I'm guilty of this too. Got called up and you sell. You don't have anything.
Right.
You have nothing left. You have nothing left in your shoebox. You have nothing left in anything because you've sold it all. So, I mean, I bet there's guys that do PC, there's guys that keep their team and stuff like that, and I think that's, you know, or certain players. But there's probably a decent percentage of guys that literally, once they get the cards, they turn around and sell them just so they can buy more. And I guess the gratification is either opening the box or watching the break, and that's the gratification. That's what they're paying for, is the rush that involves that.
Right, exactly. There's different kind of collectors out there, and there's certain collectors that are going after that. They're going for the chase. They're chasing, and that's it's the thrill of the hunt for them. And then there's certain collectors that it's the thrill of the hunt rather than it's the thrill of the hunt for that $10,000 card. It's the thrill of the hunt to hit that, you know, Kyrie Irving rookie auto. And once they hit that Kyrie auto, you know, they may not buy any more basketball, or at least of that product. Once they get it, it's like, all right, well, I'm done. I mean, we had a guy in 2012 for Triple Threat Football. He bought the same eight teams, I'm not joking you, eight teams in every single case break that we did. And we were doing all picker team style at that point. Once in a while, we were doing randoms. He bought eight teams. He was literally trying to get that eight-way booklet of Luck, RG3, Cannon, all the rookie quarterbacks. It was like an eight-way booklet out of 2012 Triple Threats. He bought into about six cases. We pulled the eight-way booklet. I never saw the guy again. I swear to God. He got the one hit that he was looking to get. He spent less than probably he would have spent on, like, maybe a case or two, you know, a half a case or whatever, and he got exactly what he wanted. So, you know, there's just different kind of collectors out there, I guess, and that's what you get to see. It's just so magnified now with the internet and the online breaks and everybody talking about everything on Twitter and everything else. So, you know.
Yeah, definitely. I feel like me and Rich are doing all the talking. Do you guys have anything to add or any points that we just kept talking over to you guys?
I'm just listening to the conversation. It's a lot of good content, you know. There is a bunch of different collectors out there, and I mean, there is guys who have PC teams, and there is guys who have PC players, but there is the aspect of gambling, and that is very apparent. And I don't know, man. I mean, it's just so easy to sell cards on your phone now, and I've done it. I mean, Doug has seen me do it. I mean, I've opened up a box and I've listed the cards right away. You know, it's just so easy to do now.
Yeah. I mean, at this point, I mean, with the iPhone, you don't even need a scanner. Just boom, take a picture, eBay app, boom. It's up within literally 2 minutes or less. And you have your listing up. So it makes it – and then, you know, you see – you check complete listings. You see what you can get for it. So, yeah, I mean
– But at the end of the day, I mean, everybody probably has something that they collect. I mean, even the gambler's mentality, even those guys, they probably still have there has to be something that they want to hold on to. Or, I mean, at that point, why wouldn't you just go buy $5,000 worth of scratchers?
Right.
I mean, there has to be something that, you know, gets their excitement going, so everybody has some kind of PC. Something they collect.
Definitely. I think so. I mean, or else they wouldn't, you know, a lot of us got started in the 80s, and a lot of us have that, you know, it's amazing how many people have that same story in this hobby, and that we all, I mean, I guess this generation or whatever you may call it, that started in the 80s with their parents or whatever, collecting sets, and then we got into high school in the 90s or 2000, early 2000s or whatever, and got away from the hobby, you know, because of the overproduction, because me personally, it was my 91 stadium club, which book value at the time was like $300. And you're like, wow, it's a $300 set. Me and my dad collected it. Awesome. And then you just watch it plummet every month. It goes down, down, down to the point where it was like $15. And you got frustrated. I got frustrated. I stopped collecting for that matter because it's like all this money we spent and time we spent. Yeah, the cards are gorgeous. I love the full bleed. It was the first Kodak photo cards that they came out with, the 91 Stadium Club. But it's like, you know, what happened? What happened with the value? Well, it was overproduction. It kind of ran through it. And then, you know, in 2008 or 9, 7, around that time, I was buying stuff on Craigslist, selling it on eBay to make a few extra bucks, and I came across a lot of this guy selling 200 cards, and they had jerseys and autos in it. My mind was blown. I didn't know that that's where this industry had gone. And so you can say that I was one of those guys that you know, the big hit brought me back in because I was like, wow, this is really cool that there's autos on these cards. You can pull them from packs and stuff like that. I went into a local card store, bought a box of, I think, a Bowman Sterling 2008, and I bought, you know, mini box for like $60 where you get two autos and a relic, and I got like a Mickey Mantle relic. And I was like, wow. You know, I was like, this is amazing to me. It was amazing to me that this industry has $300-$500 boxes, you know, at the time. And I was like, wow, this is interesting. And so I started doing some research across forums and stuff like that. But it was the overproduction that got me out of it, and it was the hits that brought me back in. And I know there's a lot of us that have that same story. So,
well, I'd argue that they may be walking down the line of overproduction again. Why base cards aren't collectible. I think if they came out, I don't know how they were able to do this, but if they were able to come out with less sets, it feels like there's just so much stuff, and it feels like people cross-collect. You know, they collect baseball, basketball, and football, or a mix of all three, and hockey. I mean, you know, there's usually – it's getting fewer and fewer the people that only collect one sport or one player or one team. You know, a lot of people dabble in a little bit of everything, and when you have, you know, like tomorrow you got – home with draft picks, you got limited football, you got immaculate basketball. It's hard to decide, and it, you know, it just waters. It feels like it just waters down what is already out there, and what is already out there is just a ton of stuff. Like, Rich, did anybody bring that up? That maybe they, did they come out with too many products, or could they space
Absolutely.
Them out better? Or how do you feel about that? Like, as kind of
that was a part of it. That was a big part of it. That was kind of tied into the watering down of checklists. That's what it alluded to, you know, too many product releases in a short amount of time. I'm right there with you, and I'm right there with that complaint as well. Don't get me wrong, as an online casebreaker, I like it because it keeps people engaged through our online business because we're constantly listing new product and people want to see what's new. They want to see what comes out. They want to see what the cards look like and et cetera, et cetera. On the other hand, being a hobby shop owner, I end up with 14 different kinds of, you know, literally the exact same product on the shelf. And I'm like, well, this one's $75, this one's $90, this one's $110, and this one's $130, and this one's $220. And they're like, okay, like, well, what's in each? And then I got to go explain, like, okay, well, this is this, and this is this. You know, okay, well, what can I get out of that one box? Pretty much the same thing you can get out of the other ones, except these ones are worth more money. You catch yourself saying that. You really do. And it gets a little frustrating, and I'm sure the collectors are as frustrated as well. It's like, all right, finally, I got my DJ Peterson Super Fractor autograph. Well, guess what? In two more months, DJ Peterson's going to be in five more products. So, you know, it's hard. They need to space them out better. They need to, and it's funny because when the calendar starts in January, everything looks nice and neatly wrapped up with a little bow tie on it. Okay, we're going to do this, and then 2 months later, this is going to come out. And then a month later, this is going to come out. And then 2 months later, this is going to come out. Well, guess what? If one of those gets pushed back, that changes everything. And they do it all the time. They push a product back, and then before you know it, they're coming out with three releases on the same day. Or two releases in the same weekend. And then you got four major companies competing against each other, and then you've got 12 releases in the same week on a really big week, or six releases, whatever it might be. And it gets absolutely flooded. And that's a big complaint that hobby store owners have. Some hobby stores aren't very big. They're very small, and they work on a very tight budget. There is not much overhead. Or not, I'm sorry, not much margin in baseball cards. There's just not. It is, if you're in the retail business, this is one of the last retail businesses you want to be in. There's not big overhead. It's not like you're selling clothing or toys. Don't even get me started on toys. You can make a fortune selling toys. If you have a good location and you have a lot of money, you know, you can make a fortune selling toys to the right people.
There's a huge markup in that. There's a huge markup in a lot of things out there retail-wise. But, you know, when there's not much overhead in something like this and you just keep on coming out with product after product after product, sooner or later the people that don't have a lot of money are going to get backed up and they're going to go out of business. And that's you're seeing that more often nowadays.
Well, and, it, you know, it's kind of comparable, and I was trying to get a great analogy for your, everybody out there because maybe they don't realize it. You know, you pre-order this stuff 6 months beforehand, and you, for one, you don't really know what who's going to be in the product or what rookie's going to take, who's going to be in it. I mean, they don't even really have – they maybe have three feature guys at the time when they sell it to you. Oh, this guy's going to be in it, you know, but they don't tell you the rest. So it's kind of like if you owned any kind of business. And so, like, for example, when they released, and Stale Gum mentioned this in the chat, the Bowman Chrome, Topps Finest, and Topps Chrome, all within 3 weeks of each other, it's kind of like if your PG&E bill, you had to pay 6 months, 1 month. You know what I'm saying? You're like, oh, well, PG&E, we're going to have you pay for 6 months in advance this month. So, you know, normally only pay like $150 a month, but, you know, we really feel like we need 6 months worth up front. So you're going to have to pay $1,000 this month. That's what it's like for the releases. These guys order 6 months in advance with all the spacing. You know, okay, we're going to space this out. And now they're like, okay, well, we're going to release all this on this week. So, you know, it's $1,000 for Bowman Chrome, $1,000 for Fine. So, yeah, you owe $3,000. You're like, wow. You know, you didn't expect it. And it's like there's really not a huge warning when it comes to it. I mean, just like this week, you got Immaculate, which, you know, people pre-ordered a while ago. You got Limited, which was a hit last year. So I guarantee people pre-ordered Limited. People had to have pre-ordered Immaculate with the basketball double rookie class. You got Sterling that did extremely well last week coming out this week. And you got Bowman's Wrap, which is a staple. So I guarantee all these shops at least ordered one or two boxes, if not cases, of this stuff, and they're all going to have to pay for it. So, you know, it's like a lot of money this week. And if the distributor would have called them and said, hey, you know, all this stuff's going to come out in this week, they probably would have been like, okay, well, I can't order that much because I can't move it all in a week. But you don't really have enough warning to do that.
Well, they should never release, like, there should never be 4 to 5 releases in 1 week. I mean, that is just, that's insane. I mean, how can a shop sustain that? I mean, how can you do it?
They don't. That's the problem. They just don't do it. They can't sustain it. They'll end up, this is the problem, is that you have distributors ordering the product, and I mean lots of this product, and then this happens, what happens is the manufacturers push all these release dates together, the distributors get backed up with the product. Now the distributors are going to call the hobby shops who didn't realize that all these products are going to come out all at once, and the distributors are like, well, too bad, I can't cut, you know, they give them a hard time about not being able to take product that they pre-ordered. If you pre-ordered it, you're taking it, like, plain and simple, unless you give them, like, a month ahead of time, like, hey, I can't really afford to take, you know, 5 cases of this product. If you tell them, like, the day of, they will ream you, and they will start cutting you, and then you won't get any of the good stuff when it comes out, the allocated product. So it's a vicious circle. It's a vicious game that's being played.
Well, can we find a silver lining in all this? Just to be on the positive tip, I guess there's a buffet of products. That's the silver lining.
There's something for everybody.
Yeah, I mean,
I guess.
No hockey this week, but then there was select hockey last week, so that's still fresh, I guess.
Well, I mean, I don't mean to keep talking to you guys. I am sorry. This is a. I have strong feelings about, you know, this hobby, and it's obviously this is what I do for a living. I mean, I care for it, and, you know, when things like this happen, it gets me a little irritated, you know. And then if you want to know a silver lining, I think that I feel like you have nothing but good products really coming out from here, almost here on out. If you look at the release calendar, we had to deal with a lot of middle-of-the-road and low-end products almost all at once, with the Bowman Chromes, the Topps Chromes, the, you know, a lot of those products really came out, the Prisms and stuff. A lot of those middle-of-the-road and lower-end products really hit all at the same time. All the base-heavy products kind of came out all at once. Now a lot of the higher-end, or at least the higher of the middle of the road, you know, high mid-end products are kind of coming out now, and the higher-end products, the Bowman Sterling football is coming out Friday. You know, I think that's something to look forward to. I think that, you know, I think there are some big rookies that are playing well in all sports right now, including basketball. Michael Carter-Williams, very exciting. I got a terrible game last night, but he's an exciting player to watch. Oladipo. You have rookies in baseball that are coming through, prospects. Chris Bryant was an absolute beast in the fall league. You know, you have new football rookies are popping up every week playing well. You know, Gio Bernard is carrying his load. Eddie Lacy's still doing well. Geno Smith's got, you know, I mean, say what you will, the guy's winning football games as a rookie with not much around him. You know, I think it's a pretty exciting time for collectors, actually. It's just, I think if manufacturers get on board with this and they tend to, you know, like Dan was saying, spacing out the releases a little bit better, it'll probably alleviate a lot of the pressure.
Yeah, most definitely. I think so. I mean, and hockey with a double rookie class is it's kind of going to maybe have the same effect that basketball had this year. And the releases, I don't know who designed. Maybe it's the patches that jade me because there's so many multicolored patches, but it just seems like whoever works for the Panini hockey department really takes the design and the collation so much better than their football department, their baseball department. I mean, they have good releases and they have bad releases, but it seems like with hockey, it seems like their releases are solid across the board when it comes to their hockey releases. So they need to give that guy a raise and teach him some football or something. maybe have this guy work like 80 hours a week or I don't know, or have him teach what he does for hockey with football and baseball. I mean, with the license. Not the license with football, you know, it's a little – I mean, with baseball it's a little tough, but – you know, I mean, they had that strong release with National Treasures, which arguably could be the best baseball release. And granted, it is high-end, but arguably could be the best baseball release in the last 3-4 years. It was National Treasures without a license.
Yep.
So at least the probably the one that sold the highest. I mean, Museum and Tribute, Tribute in 2012 really jumped up with the encased hits and stuff. But I think National Treasures baseball over the last year or two was the highest gaining product.
They should go back to the encased hits and tribute. That was a good idea. I like that.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah.
They,
and look what it did.
I'm assuming they cut it out to save money. I'm assuming.
Yep. Yeah, but I mean, this year's tribute kind of tanked. Didn't do well at all. So... yep. Maybe go back to the encased hits. I mean, add a couple bucks extra to each box. And I don't know, when you get like an encased hit, it just feels like something. It feels like you got something special. I mean, a lot of the quality of hits that were in 2013 were about the same quality as 2012. Same color relic, same numbering. It's just one's encased, one's not. The one encased feels like it's something a little bit more valuable. So I think they should go back to the encased hits. More manufacturers should do the encased hits. People always like it.
Yep. Yeah, definitely. And I wanted to, you know, while Rich is on here, I wanted to tell you guys, check out LaytonSportsCards.com. He's actually had a few breaks tonight, so make sure if you're itching to get a break tonight. What do you got going on tonight?
We may only do one break this evening unless – there's a call for more, but right now we have a box of Flawless mixed with 6 boxes of Intrigue basketball. So it's a 7-box basketball mixer random team style. We're doing that tonight. It's more or less a prerequisite break, if you will. I said to everybody in the feed the other night that if we get that filled up, I was going to list a special break of a case of Immaculate mixed with a box of Flawless, and we're going to do a snake draft with it. It should be about 34 hits, so we should be 24 hits in Immaculate and 10 from Flawless, and we're going to do a 17-spot snake draft with that, so that would be a fun one.
Nice. That's awesome. That's a good idea. I'll have to definitely get into that. And what I did want to, I kind of, not to keep switching topics here, but, you know, I guess I'm a little disappointed. Topps has products, and they have three of them. They have Bowman Draft, they have Bowman, and then they have Bowman Chrome. You know, and then Bowman Draft seems like it's, you know, the first rounders and stuff like that. But what they're doing more each year, which is disappointing because they don't let us know ahead of time. We all knew that Chris Bryant was going to be saved for Bowman, but we all kind of figured, and this is in terms of Bowman Draft, we all kind of figured that Appel would be in there. Well, he's not either, so they're saving Appel for Bowman. So, you know, it would have been nice to let us know or at least have a checklist of their plans, because I'm sure they knew the plans when they released, and this is what's going down. Not that there's not good names in Bowman Draft. There's still Reese McGuire. There's still Austin Meadows, stuff like that, but I feel like they're taking three releases when they could cut it down to maybe two and, you know, really put more prospects that are good at the beginning. I mean, some of these guys from Bowman Draft are going to hit no matter what. They're going to be $5 autos tomorrow, but they could be like a $150 auto when the season comes and these guys start tearing it up. But it just – I would really like, you know, do away with Chrome or something, or one of the do away with one of those releases and try to pack more value in the other two. It seems like Bowman Chrome is the stepchild of all this, and they get all the Dominican guys in there, and they get all the guys that they didn't get into Bowman Chrome or Bowman Draft to kind of get into Chrome. And Chrome, just last couple years, last year it had Solaire and it had Hamilton. If they didn't have those guys, that just would have been terrible. So I really that's my thoughts when it comes to that product. Would you guys share the same thing? I mean, I think
all the draft picks should be in Bowman Draft Picks and Prospects. I don't know why you would hold any of them back. I mean, that's why you buy that product from the last draft. Like, it defeats the purpose of even making the product if you start pulling out the marquee guy so you can sell next year's product. I mean, that's whack.
Well, it's wiggity whack is what it is.
Dude, it's whack.
You got to add a wiggity on it, man. It makes it even worse. Well, last year they did it with Buxton and Correa. All they had was Aflax, and they didn't have Correa or Buxton. They waited till Bowman came out. They used Bowman with Correa and Buxton. So they're going to do the same thing this year with Abreu and Bryant and Appel. They're going to be in Bowman 2014. So, you know.
What was that, Ryan?
I'm saying just get rid of the entire set then. I mean,
yeah.
Like you said, why is it called Bowman Draft Picks and Prospects and your top draft picks and prospects aren't in the set? It's literally a joke to me. I don't understand it. I mean, don't get me wrong. They do have. I mean, I'm not trying to trash the set as itself. I mean, there's going to be some big names in there. There already is some big names in there. The Clint Fraziers, the DJ Petersons, there's big guys in the set, and they're going to be worth a lot of money right out of the gate, and they're going to continue to go up. I mean, there's definitely some beasts that are in this checklist, absolutely, across the board. But at the same time, it's called Bowman Draft Some Draft Picks mm-hmm. and Prospects. Like, it doesn't make any sense that the top aims aren't in the set. They're using it for something else.
Yeah.
It defeats the purpose.
Well, and you know what's funny,
yep.
Speaking of that, and Donovan just brought this back up. I seen this a couple weeks ago. Chris Bryant, from his Twitter account, tweeted out a super fractor of himself, not signed, though, and he says, in quotes, first professional baseball card, thank you, Topps. And it's a super fractor with the grayed out area for the auto, and it's in the 2013 Bowman design. So what is going on? Where is this card going to be? That is very strange.
In
wow.
The top vault and on eBay.
Well, maybe he signed these. Yeah, exactly. Topps going to release some kind of limited edition. I bet you it's going to be part of a Blue Wave pack or something. I guarantee it. But
they'll put it in the top vault and sell it on eBay for $20,000.
Probably.
Watch.
Yeah, I mean, there's no ink on it, though, so I don't sign it or what. It says Topps Certified Autograph. This is from Chris Bryant. I bet you Topps was pissed he tweeted this out, but I don't know where this card's going to go. So maybe the original plan was to have him in Chrome or Draft. Well, no, it wouldn't have been in Chrome, but maybe Draft. And they said, oh, wait, his name to sell Chrome or Bowman that's coming out, so...
Well, I mean, was it a card that was, like, gifted to him by Topps? Or like, it was like a gift, like, here you go. Here's your first card. Check it out. Congratulations. Or was it a card that he had that he was signing and sending back?
There's a space for an auto on there, and it's a super fractor. But it's not signed yet.
Yeah, I don't know. If they were gifting him a card, why wouldn't they just gift him like a regular base card and say, hey, here's your card. Really want to throw another super fractor out there?
I have to assume that was his mail day to sign. That's what I have to assume.
Yeah.
He's going to have, I mean, his base card is in this set. Is that correct?
I'm not sure.
Or do you have to have, I mean, because he's got a Bowman Black auto and he's got an Aflac auto. So if he's got a Bowman Black auto, chances are he's got some sort of base card or insert. So shouldn't there be a super fractor of him in 2013 Bowman draft, just not an autograph?
You would think so.
But why would they send him a super fractor to have him sign and send back if there is no super fractor in the product?
Maybe their 2014 Bowman design is just so close to this year's design.
Maybe, yeah.
I mean, it does. He did say thank you, Topps, my first card. So maybe it is a gift. You know, that would maybe assume that here, this is for you. Like, keep it.
Yeah, I mean, that's a possibility. I mean, when you were telling me the story, that's what I first thought. I thought it may be a package of cards of Chris Bryant that were gifted to him from Topps. Why would they include a super fractor in there? I don't know.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Card's going to be worth a lot of money.
Oh, no doubt. I mean,
Here's a quick question for you. If this is Bowman draft picks and prospects, how come you feel Puig's in it?
Yeah,
he's a prospect, I guess.
I
don't know.
I mean, I just, you know what I'm saying? Like, where does he fit into this set? I don't quite understand. I mean, he was in Bowman Chrome. He was in Topps Chrome. He had the minis in regular Bowman. He literally hit every single Bowman set across the board, whether it be autographed or refractors or whatever. He's the only one.
It's
only Puig.
They didn't feel confident that the set would sell without him, I guess, at some point.
Well, yeah.
Well,
that's their new chase card for it.
They do this with a handful of guys. I mean, look at Tawan Walker. Tawan Walker has been a rookie for like 3 years. I mean,
Starling.
Tawan Walker. Aroldis Chapman. How long was he a rookie for? How many rookie cards did Aroldis Chapman have?
Yep.
Tons.
75.
But 150, at least. 150 sets.
I mean,
I don't know.
That's what they do, I guess.
They're just trying to add value to draft picks and prospects. I mean, good for them. I mean, by pulling out Chris Bryant, they better add something else to it.
Right.
So... we'll see. It's going to be a fun product. It's going to be a good product. There's going to always a lot of color. On-card autos, I mean, a lot of these guys, it's their first card, so it's pretty exciting.
Yeah, this is also when Beckett gets really busy. Everybody's going to be sending in for grading all at once.
Yeah, definitely. It's going to be a lot of prospects being graded. We're going to have Andrew on here shortly to talk about the Toronto Expo for hockey. I'm excited to hear about what Panini did there and stuff. So he'll be on here shortly to talk some hockey, which we don't really talk about as much. But I did want to get in with you, Rich, before we leave. What do you think is the future for, and everybody can join in, obviously, what do you think the future is for this hobby? I mean, we've kind of evolved into the group breaking industry. What do you think is the next step?
That's a really good question. And it's not an easy answer. They have tried so many different things over the last few years, which I don't think really many of them really stuck too well. In terms of the cards themselves, I feel like everything is geared more towards memorabilia, in my opinion. Obviously, everybody's already going after autographs and jerseys and autographed jerseys and such. Maybe more redemptions for full-size memorabilia autograph items, or maybe an actual, you know, where I think Brian Gray always seems to be five steps ahead of some people in some aspects of the hobby, with the autograph helmets in random boxes, the autograph jerseys in random boxes. You have Just Miners doing the autographed batting gloves and autographed cleats and autographed bats. I think that's a big part of the industry that's moving forward, or it's going to stay with us moving forward. I think Tops may get into it. Panini might get more into it. You know, you might see more of that, in my opinion. In terms of the actual, like, hobby itself, I think everything is already streaming towards the instant gratification of live online case breaking, or box breaking, or, you know, whatever, live streams that are geared towards collecting and opening baseball cards or whatever, sports cards. I think that's by far where it's heading. The actual evolution from there, I have no idea how much further it could go. Like we were saying earlier, you know, virtual cards being sold by manufacturers or something along that line, like you were talking about, Doug. I'm not sure. That's a tough question to answer. I don't know how much further it can get from the instant, like the instant knowing of what I've got immediately. This is already on its way in the mail to me, rather than, you know, having to drive to the store and then actually sit down and go through the labor of actually opening the cards and everything else. So, you know, I'm not sure where else it could go from there.
Yeah, I hear you. I was thinking maybe there'd be some crazy idea where Tops or Panini or something, and they would probably have to sublease it because then you'd cut out the middleman. But you basically have all these cards, you know, Chris Bryant, whoever, and you have it like a database. You have the actual card, and then somebody can go on and pay $4 and open a pack. And then the cards on the screen are virtual, but then you could send the cards to yourself. You could send the cards to eBay or something over the Internet, and you could keep opening and opening and opening and opening virtual packs. I don't know if that'll ever take, because I think the sports card industry is a tangible item, but, you know, it could be something in the future that could be easily done, that could happen. But let me ask you this, too. I know the Internet has kind of put a damper on the card shop, but do you think furthering that with the group break industry, do you think that has killed the card shop, so to speak, lack of a better word?
Well, I think, I hate to sound like a broken record here, but, you know, I think that a big part of the reason why it has gone that way is that, like I just said, the instant gratification, that whole, like, all you have to do literally is come home from work and sit in front of your computer and, oh, I got this card, oh, I got this card, oh, I got that card, wow, look at that, wow, look at this. You know, oh, this guy got that card. Hey, what's his email? You know, hey, Rich, how do I get a hold of this guy so I can see if he wants to trade that card or if he wants to sell that card? It happens all the time. This is very, very immediate, and that's pretty much what the Internet has done to society in general, in terms of retail in general. Retail is getting crushed by the Internet, or at least small retail has gotten crushed by the Internet. You know, it's the way society is heading. And not that there's a problem with it. That's just the natural evolution of things, I guess. It's what the Internet has done to society.
Everything's immediate. Everybody expects it, everything immediately. I think it's a wonderful thing. I think it's really cool where technology has taken us to where we're able to know what we got immediately. You know, where back when I was a kid, I mean, I'm not even that old. I used to have to ride my bike to the card shop and go in there and, you know, get a pack of cards and literally open them, and then I'd have to buy a Beckett magazine to tell me what those cards were worth. Like, and it was like a treasure hunt almost. Whereas now it's just, you know, click a button to pay, click a button to watch,
right.
Click a button to turn it on, click a button to turn it off. You know, everything's just right there at your fingertips. So I think online case breaking is just the natural progression of things. I really do. I think it's where card shops need to go. I think that's where the hobby needs to go in order to keep collectors happy. I think there's still room for hobby shops if they're operated correctly, if they advertise correctly, if they do in-store promotions, if they have a good target audience and they need a really good location in a good city area that's a year-round location where people always are going to be walking by. I really do think there's still room for hobby shops to grow out there. I think they need to build websites. I think they need to get their names out there a little bit more, be more involved online, on Twitter, social media. You know, that stuff is free. If you just get on there and learn it and take the time to figure it out. I didn't know how to use Twitter 2 years ago. That's not a joke. I had no idea how it even worked. And now we have 2,000 some odd, over 2,200 followers now. You know, and I'm on it literally all day, or at least half the day. You know, it's what they have to do. There's a lot of guys out there that they're not sure what to do. I think that's the first step they take, is getting online and seeing what it's all about and seeing why exactly people are going there. I think that would help out hobby shops a lot. So, you know,
there's some good points in the chat that I think we have talked about in earlier episodes that, you know, a lot of people don't know about autographs and hits in the products. You show your friends that, you know, you're out, like, you see a friend from high school and you tell them what you do, and they're like, wow, that's in cards. Like, they do that now? I mean, it doesn't seem like there's as good a marketing as there really needs to be. And I know an ESPN 30-second ad can cost card manufacturer $5 million, and it's probably not feasible. But I think there needs to be some kind of extra marketing steps to let people know that there is these kind of hits and cards, because some of these guys go and buy jerseys of their favorite player, Pedro Martinez or Derek Jeter, and they have them on their wall, and those might be the target audience that would buy cards of their favorite player, but they don't know that they're out there.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I totally agree. We have people, I mean, even like friends of mine that, you know, from older friends of mine that I haven't seen in a while that come into our shop. They're like, wow, you opened the shop? This is great. You know, dude, I didn't know people still collected these things. It's usually about the third sentence I hear. People still collect this stuff? I can't believe it. Dude, I've got all these old cards from the 90s. I'm like, yeah, they're not worth anything. I'm sorry, man. Unless you got a junior or Derek Jeter, you know. But, yeah, I'm like, you know, this is what it's evolved to. And I show them, you know, the jersey cards and the autographs and the bat plates and the bat knobs and this and that. And they're like, oh, my God. I mean, even like my dad, who collected cards in the 50s, in the 60s, you know what I mean? He had, you know, full sets of 1955 Bowman and 56. And 57, you know, he was a hardcore collector when he was young, and he loved doing it. And he stopped for a long time, and then he got back into it when I was a kid, and then obviously the bubble burst, and we, you know, I went on playing baseball and this and that. Well, when I got the shop open, he got to see some of these cards coming out, and I was showing him pictures and this and that, and we pulled, you know, like a Ted Williams, we pulled that one Ted Williams nameplate, where the stitching of the nameplate of his jersey was on one side and the autograph on the other side or whatever it was out of NT Baseball. And my dad saw that card. He was absolutely blown away. Like, and it kind of almost sprung him back into wanting cards and stuff like that. So every once in a while, I give him a new card, and, like, here's an autograph of Dustin Pedroia or whatever. He's a Red Sox fan like me. So, you know, just like you said, there's a lot of people out there that do not know how far the hobby has progressed since they knew about cards in the 90s, you know, and they need to get it out there more. You're absolutely right.
Definitely. Well, Rich, we won't take any more of your time because I know you got a break coming up. I know you got to get prepared for that. But I wanted to let people know to check out LaytonSportsCards.com and follow you on Twitter at rlayton42 on Twitter to find out the latest happenings. And always a pleasure to have you on, and we'll do it again soon.
Thanks a lot, guys. Doug, Dan, Brian, hope you guys have a great night, and we'll talk to you soon.
All right. Take care, Rich.
Take care.
Thanks, guys.
Well, and I did, you know, I was scouring Twitter before we bring Andrew on real quick. I was on, because it was Chris Bryant's Twitter account that that card was that Donovan linked up, and I happened to, this is going to show you how much of a Twitter stalker I am. I clicked on, he had his girlfriend's picture on there, and I clicked on her Twitter account. And she had it, check this out. So I get there's a picture of Chris Bryant at the Arizona Fall League, right? And I look at it, and she goes, thanks to @SportsCardNews for the picture. I was like,
yeah,
wow,
she tweeted me.
Yeah.
Chris Bryant, you'd be surprised how actually often that has happened, to be honest. Like, I've had text message conversations with players' girlfriends. I've emailed back and forth with players' girlfriends because the players' girlfriends search their because I'll write about prospects and I'll tweet about prospects sometimes. So I'll put up some pictures, and they'll contact me and say, and there was even one time where I said, you know, this guy has a really hot girlfriend. And the girl actually contacted me through email to say that she was thankful that I said she was hot in some article I wrote. So you'd be surprised. If these girlfriends are on it, like on it. And they're gorgeous, too. These girls are like just drop dead gorgeous. And, yeah, I remember that. I remember sitting there. It took me a second to realize that it was his girlfriend. But I remember sitting at the game being like, oh, that's cool. That's his girlfriend or whatever. Oh, that's cool. I'm glad she found that picture. Like, that's pretty cool. So that happens at least a couple times a year where I get a girlfriend to either Twitter or email or even text sometimes. If they, I get their number or whatever, and we text back and forth. And it's kind of interesting. Maybe they have a sister or something.
Yeah, I mean, I'll say it's not bad on the eyes for sure. I mean, none of these baseball players' girlfriends are. I mean, he could be. I mean, I'm sure, and I'm not hating on John Kruk because I'm not easy on the eyes either. But I'm sure he had a freaking extremely hot wife while he was playing too. So, you throw the ball, you hit the ball, you do something. Even if you're riding the pine, you got a nice looking girl. So, anyways, enough to about that. I don't want to get weird on you guys, but I did want to bring Andrew on to talk a little bit of Expo. I mean. Because I wasn't there. There was a lot of buzz. Panini was doing the VIP event again there like they did at the Summit. And they had some nice, you know, signers there and stuff. So we're going to go ahead and bring Andrew on, who attended the event. What's going on, Andrew?
Not much. How's it going, guys?
What's going on?
Good, man.
That's good. Expo.
Give us an overview of the event, like we would never have been there, never heard anything about it, as much as you can.
Oh, okay. Well, this is actually the third Expo I've gone to because they have the Spring Expo and the Fall Expo. The Fall Expo is definitely a much bigger event. The card companies actually all come in, and they have several rows of all it is dealers just selling singles, selling boxes. You can get everything from current products to products back in the from the 80s, 90s that are like $5 a box type things. You've got all your memorabilia type guys that are selling autographed pictures, jerseys. There's actually a guy there that was selling a couple chairs from the Montreal Forum. And then you get to the back of it, and that's where you've got in-the-game land set up for in the game cards. Right beside them is Panini. Right beside them is Upper Deck. And then at the very back is where they have the big autograph section for whatever players happen to be brought in. And this year, of course, Mario Lemieux was there as the big draw. So it's a great place if you're looking for singles. You can go in there and you're pretty much guaranteed to find what you're looking for if you're looking for a specific single, or if you don't see it there, there's a guy that knows where to get it. So it's great for adding to your PC and going forward on that stage, but just breaking product is always fun there because each of the card companies sets up their booth and they have special redemptions for the Fall Expo.
Nice. And how big was the place? I mean, football field-wise, how many football fields would you say the whole place was?
Canadian or U.S. football fields?
U.S. football fields.
You know what? I'm not even really sure. I'm guessing it's a couple football fields in length. It seems to have grown every time I've gone, and this year seemed to be a bit bigger. My feet were definitely a lot sore after walking around for 2 days, so I'd say it's a couple football fields in length for sure. And then,
nice. And do they have it at the same place? Is it at the same place every year, or do they do different locations?
Yeah. No, it's the same place. It's actually called the International Center. It's just right by the airport, so if people are flying in, you can stay at a hotel by the airport and you can get there pretty quickly. I stayed at a hotel that was close to the airport. Like, the runways were actually right behind the airport, or right behind the hotel, and I walked the 7 blocks to the International Center to go to it because I didn't feel like paying for a cab.
Right.
So.
And what was the big buzz? I mean, which manufacturer do you think stood out as far as their promotion?
I'm going to preface this by saying that I'm a Panini fanboy, so I think Panini did a much better job with the buzz and getting their booth going, and this year they actually had the Panini girls there as well, which they had a couple girls wandering around that were wearing very short shorts that were extremely tight and white tight Panini double rookie class shirts on, and they definitely drew your eyes to them no matter what.
Nice.
So, yeah. So they
I wonder if those
in.
Are the same girls that they had at the National, or they just kind of hire in different cities.
I think they hire them as they go probably. But
yeah, they actually they do. I actually overheard a couple of the girls talking with Tim about the VIP party and whatnot, and he actually asked them where they work, and they said they worked for a modeling agency that Panini hired these girls through. So they were local Ontario girls, and Panini hired them to walk around in the scantily clad clothing to draw attention to themselves.
I love Panini.
At the National, they were just like force-feeding them alcohol at the VIP party so that they were a little more fun, I guess, but I don't know if they did that at the expo, but that's what they were doing at the VIP event.
Unfortunately, I didn't make it into the VIP party because I didn't have $5,000 to spend on cards, but from the pictures that I saw, they were definitely feeding the girls alcohol at that party as well.
Oh, okay. That seems like the company motto there. So,
yeah.
Which, you know, I mean, the collectors are 95% male. It's nice to get, I guess, something else in there to, I guess, look at other than cards, I guess, without being creepy. But, yeah, you know. So
absolutely. It's definitely the creepy factor, but it's kind of a neat place to go, especially if you're a hockey fan. Like, we'll start at the one end you got in the game. Dr. Brian Price brings his jersey collection with him whenever he sets up the in-the-game land. And you get to see some amazing jerseys from, like, the 1930s, 1940s, 1950s. And then there was a couple jerseys there that were, like, from the Winter Classic, Carey Price jersey, and things like that. So you get to see the differences in the jerseys. And you look at some of those old wool jerseys, and it's like, how the hell did a player ever play in those? Because they're small, they're wool. And the sweat probably just soaked them and added about 30 pounds to them every game. So it's kind of neat to see those. And then they draw people in twice a day for their deal or no deal, and then in the game gives a sheet promotion. And basically the deal or no deal, it's the same as on the TV show. They've got 8 boxes. You pick a box, and then you start opening up the other boxes, and Brian Price is sitting there with his phone, and he sees what you've taken off the board, and then he phones the guy that's running the game and makes an offer, and the person either refuses or continues going, and they hope that they get the one book of superlative, which is the top prize.
Actually, that was a perfect segue. I was just going to ask you, that just basically released about 4 days ago, I'm sure that was kind of what they were really kind of promoting there, which is just like amazing.
They were definitely promoting the superlative, and if you opened up a case of it at their in-the-game land, you actually got this one-of-a-kind redemption with the original 6 players on it, and it looked like a very cool card, and I saw a few people breaking it open, and nobody seemed upset when they opened the box, so looked like a good product.
Right.
Unfortunately, I didn't buy one.
Is that product all just based around the original 6 teams, or does it have other...
Yeah, this version of the superlative was the superlative original 6, which was the original 6 teams, and it had current-day players as well as the older-time players and some really old players, and they all had jersey swatches and autographs of players that were still alive or cut autographs of dead players, that sort of thing. So
nice.
Definitely a very cool high-end product if you could afford to buy it.
Nice. And I know it's kind of early on in the season, but what has been your favorite hockey product so far?
You know, it's still fairly early. I did like Prime. Like, I know Prime is still sort of considered last year's players just because they didn't have the double rookie class in that version of Prime. It's the 2012-2013 Prime, not 2013-14. But, of course, I like Prime. It's a high-end product. You get some really nice hits out of it. The silver engravatures are beautiful if you can find them and get them. The big push at the Expo was Panini pushing Select and Upper Deck pushing their Series 1.
Right.
I personally preferred Select out of the two products, and I saw people breaking several cases of Select, mainly those guys trying to get into the VIP party. I think you had to break 3.5 cases of Select in order to spend the $5,000 and get into the VIP party, but guys were breaking it, and nobody seemed upset when they were breaking it. Everybody was getting good hits, and you've got a good mix of your rookie card autographs, jerseys, prime patches, some really cool insert cards in it. And then you got to go over to Upper Deck, and they had their Upper Deck Series 1 was their brand new release to come out just before the Expo, and that, of course, brings your Young Guns, which, to me, I still don't understand why everybody gets so excited about the Young Guns other than the history behind it, because they're not short-printed, they're not numbered, they're just the rookies, and they say Young Guns on them.
Well, they do have some. It's funny that you mentioned that. It's like we're looking at the same thing, because I had the original 6 thing up, and now I have the Young Guns up on eBay. It's like you're looking at my screen. it looks like there are some that are numbered to 100. It looks like there's a Thomas Hertl that sold for like 180 and it's numbered to 100. Was that like a show exclusive, or do you know if that's the...
No, what it is they do have the parallels. Like just the base Young Gun set, they're not short printed or anything else. They're just a regular card. But then they did have a parallel version numbered to 100 and another parallel version numbered to 10.
Hmm.
But they're just the Young Guns, and I think the back is just slightly different colored.
Yeah, it looks like the number to 10 is a high gloss, they call it, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, it looks
but
like there was
again,
a nail that sold for like $900, number to 10, without an auto on it or anything. That's ridiculous. That's good, but
wow.
Ridiculous.
Yeah,
wow.
It's good, but I find it kind of ridiculous, the people that have the massive hard-on, for better terms, for these Young Guns cards, because I never understood what the big deal is it's a rookie card just like any other rookie card I can pull off of the Panini Select cards. They have the rookie cards there as well. But because Upper Deck has that history behind them, a lot of people just automatically, well, oh, it's Upper Deck. That card's got to be worth more.
Yeah, and there's a lot of guys that try to buy them ungraded, get it graded, and then, you know, turn a $20, $30 profit on the Young Guns. I think that's really popular amongst hockey cards to do that.
Yeah, absolutely. And there was actually a guy at the show, and he, I think he, over the weekend and just before the weekend, I think he had opened up either 6 or 10 cases of Upper Deck Series 1, just trying to collect all the Young Guns, and then he takes it over to Beckett and gets them all graded.
Wow.
And then turns around and sells them. So it's a big
thing
now.
The Beckett line, because I know at the National, they basically filled, if you wanted to get something graded while you were there over the weekend, they filled up like within the first morning, so you had to actually set it in. Were you able to get it graded and throughout the weekend, or was there a cutoff for them?
I believe there was a weekend. I personally, I don't grade my cards, so I walked by the Beckett booth a few times, and I did say hi to Susan and introduce myself to her because she was there, and there always seemed to be a group of people around, and from what I understood, a lot of the grading couldn't be done at the show because they just had too many people, and so they would send them back to you once they were graded. So I think they did fill up at a certain point, or if you dropped off, say, 1,000 cards, they weren't going to grade all 1,000 of them right then and there. They'd put them aside and then mail them back to you sort of thing.
Now, did Check Out My Cards, did they have a booth out there?
Yeah, they did have a booth, and they were handing out free boxes just to put your cards, all your card hits, and just trying to promote their site. So they're there. They were actually right beside the Beckett booth. So,
oh, nice.
You walk by one, and you see the next one. And it was kind of nice to see.
So, nice. Now, were there more people there this year, you'd say, because of the double rookie class, or what do you think?
I would definitely say there was more people there. Like the Friday seemed to be quieter than last year at this time, but the Saturday there, I think it's a bit because of the double rookie class, but also because Mario was there. The Saturday,
yeah,
it filled up pretty quick, and there seemed to be huge crowds everywhere of people just hanging around. And yeah, Mario definitely had his long lineup of people. Like when I got to Toronto, I met with a friend, and he, as soon as we got in there first thing in the morning, he went straight to the Mario line, and he was in the Mario line for 3 hours before he ever even got on the show floor, because he went and he got a photo with them and then got his jersey signed, and it took him 3 hours to get all that done.
Wow.
So there was definitely the big draw there.
Definitely. Now, I mean, in terms of hockey rookies this year, besides, you know, Galchenyuk, Hurdle, Jones, Yakupov, and McKinnon, who would you say would be a good guy to invest in that you think is going to have a good season?
Hurdle's value is definitely going up really quick. This was a guy that nobody really talked about, nobody really heard of until his four-goal game. And
Right. Once
that four-goal game happened, his stock just went through the roof, and I actually jumped on the bandwagon and added him to my fantasy league just because
nice.
I figured the other players that I had was sucking, so I dropped him and picked up Hurdle, figuring, hey, this kid's on fire right now. And he has dropped off a lot since that four-goal game, but he still, for a rookie, is producing a lot faster than most people thought he would. So I think his cards are going to continue going up in value. Galchenyuk, definitely. Anything Galchenyuk is going through the roof, because with him playing on a line with Lars Eller and Brendan Gallagher, the three of them are seeming to be unstoppable. You've got Galchenyuk, who has super soft hands. Eller has no problem going into a corner and beating the crap out of someone to get the puck out. And then you've got Gallagher, who's 5'8", I think, and his balls are about 5'8" as well, because he will fight anybody in order to get in front of that net and get to the puck. So Gallagher and Galchenyuk, both their rookie cards are going to continue going up in price. Yakupov might actually start dropping in value, in my opinion, just because of what's going on in Edmonton. He's not getting the ice time. He's been benched a couple times, sent to the press box a couple times, has really poor numbers, and his agent actually just came forward this weekend at the Hall of Fame induction ceremony and suggested that if Edmonton was not happy with him, perhaps they would rather trade him to any team in the NHL that would love to have him instead. So there's a bit of a storm around Yakupov. Seth Jones and MacKinnon, definitely those guys are going to continue going up in value as well. You get Pulla Hubador, his value is going up as well. So you've got quite a few that you can pull that are played last year but are still considered rookie cards this year that are going to continue going up, and a couple of the guys will be surprises. Another guy that definitely you want to jump in on the ground floor on him is Sean Monahan. Young guy, plays for the Flames, is having an amazing season for a 19-year-old.
Nice. Good stuff. Yeah, I mean, it's an exciting time, and there's going to be some great release. I actually like I'm more of a Panini guy, too, but I did actually like Artifacts. I really like the set design, the patches.
Yeah.
And it was a pretty good price point for what you got out of the box. So, I'm mostly a Panini guy, too, but I really like the opening Artifacts.
You know what? I actually, usually every year I'll buy one or two boxes of Artifacts. And at the show, I was really debating as to what I was going to buy because I was on a limited budget. I only wanted to buy two boxes of cards. I ended up buying two boxes of Select, and the only reason I did that is because of something that happened at the Upper Deck booth that pissed me off on Friday night.
share.
I'll share, but I won't share names. How's that sound?
Okay, there we go.
So Upper Deck had their redemption program going, and what their redemption program was that they only do it a couple times a day, where if you showed up with a box of Artifacts or Upper Deck Series 1, you got to pull a card out of their magic box, and you were guaranteed an autograph. You weren't guaranteed who it was going to be, whether it would be a good autograph or a bad autograph, but it was hand-numbered, hand-signed. So it's not a bad redemption. But then for Case Breakers, what they did is they actually had it listed. You were allowed to do one case break per person per day. And what you did is you got a ticket. And that ticket was for a high-value item out of one of their cases. And every item had a ticket beside it, and you pull your ticket and you match up the item. And it could be a card numbered to 3 or less. It could be an autographed stick, an autographed helmet, autographed picture, something like that. But it was a high-value item.
Yeah.
And there was a particular store Friday night that came up to the Upper Deck booth and started breaking cases. And the only cases that they had listed were Trilogy and Flair Retro. Now, we all know Flair Retro tanked. It was a crappy product at a high price. It tanked. So this store owner went over to the Upper Deck booth, and he started breaking cases. And every case that he broke, he got a ticket. And it was overheard. Now, it wasn't overheard by me, but it was overheard by somebody that I trusted to say that he told Upper Deck that he was going to continue breaking cases until he hit the LeBron James 1-of-1 autograph.
Huh.
Now, what upset me about this was that he ended up breaking, I think, 40 cases Friday night, which means a lot of the people that weren't going to be there until Saturday or Sunday, he was actually taking most of the tickets, if not all the tickets, and they weren't going to have a chance to, which then it hurts all the other stores that are trying to sell off these cases of Flair Retro and Trilogy that didn't do so well.
Right.
But if there's no redemption items, they're not going to do it. Now, I don't know if you saw on Twitter, but somebody called Upper Deck out on this. And Upper Deck's response was, no, no, he was breaking it for his clients. He had several clients that wanted to break a case that couldn't make it to the show, so he was breaking it for them.
Right.
Which I would have bought that if I hadn't have overheard the comment that he was breaking until he hit the LeBron James. And I would have bought it if he had a camera set up and he was breaking it and recording all of it. But he did not record any of it. There was not a computer anywhere in sight. There was not a camera anywhere in sight. And I don't know any case breaker or company that would break cases of cards without filming it to prove to the client what cards they got. There were no cameras there. He also had Upper Deck people as well as other people breaking open cases for him. And every time a case got cut open, he was handed the ticket, and he would go through and look for the item that was the ticket represented.
Wow.
So for me personally,
so he got all the extra bonus stuff and probably sold it all and profited with all that stuff.
Exactly. And honestly, I wouldn't have had an issue if he did it Sunday afternoon at the end of the show. It would have given all the other case breakers chances to actually pull those items. Or if Upper Deck said at the end, you know what, you spend so much money with us, we're just going to give you these items because we don't want to ship it back to California with us.
Right.
To do it Friday night and then turn around and say, no, he was doing it for clients on Twitter, that sort of soured me towards Upper Deck a bit. So
that's souring. Imagine the people that maybe told their local card shop that was going to have a booth there, that I'll buy a case from you because I really want to pull this stick or whatever they had there, and now they go there and they're all gone, and they go, well, I'm not going to buy it now.
Yeah,
exactly.
So that one just, honestly, Upper Deck has been going down in my books for quite a while, and that was sort of the last straw. Like, I do like artifacts. I'll probably still continue to buy one box of artifacts a year just to see what I could pull. But for the most part, I'm sticking with Panini. You go to the Panini booth, and you could go at any time. You open up a box of their product. You get their redemption packs. You have the chance to pull a signed baseball cap from a rookie player. You had signed rookie draft tickets. You had their hand-drawn cards that they had in there. Plus, you had the chance to pull autographs. I saw one guy, he opened up a box of Select. He got his 12 redemption packs. He pulled a Jean Beliveau hard-signed card out of his redemption pack.
Wow.
So it's like those redemption packs were pretty cool, and it was all on the up and up. Case breakers.
Exactly.
Same thing. Like, the case breakers were pulling stuff. After they finished their case breaks, they were handed their green Select numbered to 5 or 10 autographed patch rookie card. That's what you got for breaking a case of Select at this show.
Oh, nice.
And plus you got the 144 redemption packs on top of that green Select card. So there was an advantage for opening up a full case of it. The guys that got their VIP party, from what I understand, they got, I think, 50 or 75 gold redemption packs as they walked in the door at the VIP party, plus they got a black box. So
nice.
That was kind of neat. At the Panini booth, they also did their box wars every day. They did several box wars, and the winner of the box war got a black box. And you opened it up, you had your one-of-one cards in the black boxes. And Saturday night, I was actually there. The last box war that they did was a box of Prime. And they had 10 people show up, and they were just about to start it, and 11th guy showed up, and they said, okay, the best card pulled wins. And it was Chris Barr and Dave Sharp were the two guys that were deciding what the best card was. Dave Sharp is the Panini CSM guy, and Chris Barr is Panini Puck, who is actually in charge of cutting up the swatches and jerseys and everything for the hockey product. So those two were the ones that were going to say what the best card was. The last guy in didn't even know what he was playing for, opened up the box of Prime, pulled, I believe it was a Jonathan Toews Prime logo, part of the Blackhawk uniform. It was like 8-color, just beautiful.
Wow.
Beautiful card. He won it, and his winning prize was entry to the VIP party.
Wow. That's awesome.
Yeah. So he came in. He didn't even know what he was playing for. He's just like, I'm in, and dropped it down again with that card.
Nice.
So, but it was just amazing things. And like you were saying, like earlier with Rich, you were saying how the guy that cuts up the swatches for hockey should get a raise and talk to the guys over in baseball and football. That would be Chris Barr. He's the guy. He's the guy that does that. And when he saw that tase pulled out, he goes, you know what? It took me forever to go through that because I wanted to cut it just perfectly to get all of those colors and those the feathers and everything else into that one patch. He goes, it took me forever to do it, but I wanted to make sure that 8 colors were all in that one patch.
Nice. Yeah, it's taking the extra time, you know. And actually, we're getting a little short on time. We have about 4 minutes before the show ends. So, Andrew, we'll get you a free spot in our next select hockey break for coming on and telling us about the expo. We really appreciate it.
Oh, no problem. If you guys ever want to talk to hockey, just shoot me a direct message on Twitter, and I'll make sure I'm around, and I can pop on and talk hockey with you guys at any time.
Awesome, yeah, and I know with this fellow rookie class and the season in full swing, we'll definitely be contacting you.
Okay, sounds good.
All right, man, take care.
Thanks.
All right, bye. Good stuff, man. You know, that's more hockey than I know about. I'm starting to learn a little bit more, but, you know, it's good to get somebody who actually collects hockey. I mean, we break hockey. I'm getting more in tune with the names and some of the bigger players watching Sharks games, but cool that they do that expo, and it's cool that all those companies that are there are represented. And sad to hear about Upper Deck on that one. You know, that's kind of a lack of a better term, kind of a Bush League move. You know, they just figure they give it to the biggest spender, I guess. You know, and that's really
money,
not fair for the average player.
Money signs, man, money signs. I mean, somebody's willing to come up. I mean, 40 like 40 cases of retro basketball.
No, it was probably retro hockey, I would assume. Retro hockey.
No, he was looking for the LeBron James 101 auto.
No, he said no, the 101 auto was
it was one of the prizes. Okay.
Yes.
Okay, but still, that was like a relatively high-end product. Cases and cases of that. We're talking probably $50,000-$60,000.
Well, the guy probably figured he could get $10,000 for the LeBron, though. You know what I'm saying? So, I mean, 40 cases, I mean, you know, I mean, he's still barely going to break even, but you figure you get all those prizes and then you get a couple big hits. I mean, he may have profited.
Yeah, that's the product that has the PMGs, right?
Yeah,
right.
Yeah, and it has 9 autos. You can get Gretzky and stuff. So I mean, he may have done well. I mean, he may have, and then you get that LeBron, and Andrew was saying there's like sticks that were signed. There's probably some Gretzky stuff that he got too. So yeah, and the guy may have looked at what they had for prizes and said, hey, I'm going to do this and just get it all. And they let him.
Whew. Yeah.
I mean, that guy possibly may have profited like $20,000 with all that memorabilia that he got.
Maybe.
And the Panini VIP party sounds like. I'm thinking about doing that next year. Just buy into it and get those, what do you say, 50 to 75 gold packs or something, right? At Dunn Street. It's like, I might do that next year and see if I can come up. You know,
yeah.
$5,000 to make $6,000 and get some girl to rub some titties in my face or something, you know.
Pretty much, yeah. I mean, and you could work, I mean, we could always use the product too, so we could work something out next year, you know, with that.
Yeah.
But we got 60 seconds, I guess. So we're tomorrow, if you want to check out mojobreak.com, we got Bowman Draft, we got Immaculate, so check that out. And as always, I was looking at the checklist on sportscardradio.com for Bowman Draft. So if you're looking to see who's in the set, you can always go on sportscardradio.com.
We'll be back next week with maybe we'll have another guest. We'll announce that shortly. Follow us at Card Radio Live on Twitter. Other than that, you guys got anything else to say?
No, let's. I'm stoked for tomorrow. There's 17 releases tomorrow, so get ready.
Yep, and news to come on Ryan's super product coming out. We'll have some more details as weeks go by. Twerk and work, baby.
Chris Ryan's girlfriend is going to tweet me. Chris Ryan's girlfriend is going to tweet me about it. So, Chris Ryan's going to be in the product. Exclusive news. Chris Ryan's going to be in the product. And his girlfriend, too.
Nice. Well, I'm going to play the outro, and I think we're actually off the air, but it's recording. It's kind of weird. I don't know how this Blog TV thing works. But, look for Chris Bryant's girlfriend signing in Ryan's product and tweeting him out. Check that out. And we'll see you guys next week. We're out.
All right. Later.
Thank you for listening to another episode of Sports Card Live, sponsored by SportsCardRadio.com, MojoBreak.com. Check us out every Tuesday live at 4 p.m. Pacific, 7 Eastern, or download us on iTunes.